And now, with more astronomical news and things to watch out for in the night sky this month, here's Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society.
There's a lot going on in the world of astronomy, as ever, and I thought I'd focus on three things. The first is a really quite extraordinary discovery that probably deserves a bit more credit and publicity of these so-called dark galaxies. Now, a galaxy, the kind of thing that we're, I'd say, familiar, I probably should hesitate to say that, but a galaxy is a big sort of assembly of stars, or at least that's the ones that we're used to seeing. So the one we live in, the Milky Way, has something like 300 to 500,000 million stars, so really a vast number of them. And then it's also got gas and dust. Now, these objects, if you add up all the light from them, are quite bright. That doesn't mean that, you know, we see most of them as bright, because they also typically tend to be a long way off, perhaps millions or even billions of light years away from the Earth. And when something is that far away, it's inevitably very faint. But nonetheless, you know, they are objects that contain a lot of stars. But the European Southern Observatory and astronomers using that, and specifically the Very Large Telescope and 8-meter telescope in Chile, have looked at the galaxies in the early universe, and what they were looking for were objects that hadn't yet formed stars, and as a result they call them dark galaxies because they're not shining yet. Now, you and I would logically think, well, dark galaxy means how on earth do you see it? And the answer is they looked for something nearby that was illuminating it in ultraviolet so that it fluoresced in much the same way, I don't know, if you go to a sort of cheesy disco, or you went like me to cheesy discos in the late 1980s, if you were wearing anything white that had been washed, then it would glow under the UV disco lights. So the scientists involved in this in Zurich and in California have managed to find these objects for the first time. And it's a big step forward, because there would have been a period in the early universe, we think, when there were objects which were basically clumps of gas and dust that were going on to form stars. And then those objects in turn would go on to form the galaxies we see today.
So what is the source that they're using? What is their enormous astronomical blacklight?
Well, they're using a nearby quasar, an object that emits a lot of ultraviolet light. I mean, you could almost have a whole discussion about this as well, but quasars are very bright objects. They're thought to be where material is falling into a black hole, and as it goes in, it shines very, very brightly. There aren't that many close to us, actually. They tend to be at very large distances, but because they're so bright, we can spot them. And the light from this, the ultraviolet radiation from this, is lighting up these dark objects. I mean, if it wasn't there, we basically wouldn't be able to see them, but the fact that we can see a number of them suggests that there are an awful lot of them out there that, you know, if you multiply this very small field of view, you take it across the whole sky, there must be literally billions of them.
So is this the first time we've really been able to observe these dark galaxies? And do they look like we expected them to?
This is certainly the first time that we've got a visual discovery of this kind. And there's lots of implied things there. I mean, you know, if you think about the way that we go from the cosmic microwave background, the kind of very last surface of the universe that we can see, or if you like, perhaps a better worded way of describing it, is the very earliest light that we can see in the universe, through to the galaxies and the stars that we're familiar with today. There's a whole range of steps through that. And this is an important part of that. So what we're doing here is starting to track back to the time when the very first galaxies were forming. And that, this is an exciting time. I mean, when you get the larger telescopes on stream at the end of the decade, the EELT, the European Extremely Large Telescope, and the James Webb Space Telescope that will be in orbit around the Earth from 2018, 2019 or so, they should be able to study things like this in even more detail.
And now, going from very dark galaxies to something we can see in our own night sky, we have a meteor shower to look out for later on this month.
We do. It's the annual Perseids meteor shower. The best time in the UK will be either early on the morning of the 12th of August or early on the morning of the 13th of August, because the shower maximum is roughly between these two times. But it's a very reliable source of meteors or shooting stars. And I think most people have seen a shooting star or meteor once in their life. You know, you look up and you see this streak of light. The frustrating thing I always find with this is if you see it, it's too late to point it out to anybody else because, you know, quite often they only last about half a second. But they can be quite spectacular. The Perseids is an example where the Earth runs into a stream of clumpier material. These meteors, I should explain, are caused by really quite small particles of dust and sand-sized objects, and perhaps occasionally things up to pebble size. But nonetheless, because they're coming into the atmosphere at such high speed, they burn up very quickly, the air around them gets superheated, and that's the streak of light we see as a meteor. Now, in the case of the Perseids, over a period from late July through to late August, you get this shower which ramps up in intensity, and around the 12th or so is about the peak, when you might see around 60 an hour if you're lucky. Again, it's one of those things where you can't put a precise number on it because it depends exactly how thick the clump of stuff we go through is. But if you've got a clear sky, there is a a bit of moon in the sky, which doesn't help. But if you put that behind you and you've got a clear sky and you're up in early in the morning on the 12th, I'd be surprised if you didn't see anything. It really is something to get up for if you've got a warm night and the weather's nice.
Excellent. And from things showering down onto Earth, we go to a man-made object landing on the surface of Mars. Tell me more about Curiosity.
Well, Curiosity is NASA's flagship Mars mission that's set to land on the Red Planet in early August. And it looks like a pretty impressive piece of work. It's going to be a large rover. It's going to drive around the surface of Mars for a long time. Like its predecessors, it'll be remote controlled from the Earth. I mean, if you imagine the ultimate remote controlled car where you sit in California or somewhere, probably with a joystick, I've never done this, and steer this thing that's millions of miles away, I think it must be a lot of fun. But the serious work is about landing this thing, getting it onto the surface and exploring to see how habitable Mars is now and how habitable it might have been in the past. Now, I should stress that it's never been a particularly, or in recent times, it's never been a particularly clement place. It's pretty dry. It's got a thin atmosphere that lets lots of radiation from the sun onto its surface. And the thin atmosphere is also made of carbon dioxide, so it would be not only cold and hostile and radioactive to us, it would also be poisonous. But nonetheless, there is the thought that its past Mars might just have hosted life, or that there might be some primitive life deep within the surface today, and that's partly what the mission is about. It's also designed to prepare for, perhaps in 20 years' time, a mission for astronauts going there. Now, I think that's a long way off. It's been 20 years away for as long as I can remember, in fact, for more than 20 years. But nonetheless, I think it'll do some good science. There are some really interesting things about it. I mean, it's using this sky crane device to land on the surface, which has never been tried before, whereby the whole thing comes into the Martian atmosphere on a parachute. The parachute detaches, some retro rockets fire to slow it down, and then another device with more rockets on it called a sky crane takes over and gently lowers the rover onto the surface. And, you know, fingers crossed, because no one's ever tried this before, so good luck to the engineers involved for designing this one, and it'll be impressive if this works.
That sounds very exciting. I've always been amused by the idea of conversations between the people that design the rover itself and the planetary scientists who say, we want to land in this really exciting, interesting area, whereas the people designing the rover say, we want to land in the flattest, safest, dullest area we can see. Do we know whereabouts it's landing and how they've managed to come to a compromise?
Well, I mean, the compromises and these kind of things are, you know, that's just how it has to be. It's landing in a place called Gale Crater, which has got a reasonably flat surface, but also some canyons. And the landing ellipse, the kind of error in the region where it might come down, is designed to avoid those, but also be close enough to the canyons and the features that they can go and have a look if they want to. So one of the other techniques they're using is a descent camera. And as the probe comes into the atmosphere, it'll basically be looking at the ground where it's coming in, and using that, scientists on Earth can then decide where they want to take the rover. So in other words, work out more closely where they've landed and design their itinerary from there. But you're absolutely right. I mean, in theory, the best possible thing, I suppose, would be to try and land in, I don't know, one of the caves that have been discovered on Mars, or deep down in one of the rift valleys. But that would be a pretty hard thing to do. On the other hand, if someday we do manage it, it's probably one of the most interesting spots to look at.
Robert Massey from the RAS. And if the skies are clear, do try and get out there and watch the Perseids. A few years ago, when the peak of the Perseids coincided with a new moon, I did put in the extra effort to get away from city lights, and it really does make a difference. It's quite a fantastic light show.